Experience has shown, not only in South Africa but globally, the more removed the decision maker is from the resource in terms of determining its usage, the more likely the decision of that decision maker is going to benefit other people removed from that resource rather than the people directly related to it.
The environmental movement in South Africa on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. South Africa is a land of incredible beauty, full of soaring mountains, lush hills and valleys, amazing wildlife, and a coastline that sweeps from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. This is the sound of the Cape of Good Hope, the southwesternmost point in Africa, where the two oceans come together. Magellan and the other Western explorers spoke of this cape as the key milestone in their voyages to the Far East. Now the cape is the chief attraction in the Cape of Good Hope Nature Reserve, where baboons and other animals run free. But for all its natural beauty, South Africa also has some of the most monumental environmental problems in the world.
We have no mass-based environmental movements. In fact, it's the opposite. The environment is stigmatized because environmentalism has been defined to mean the protection of plants, threatened plants and animals and wilderness areas. And conservation, in other words, it's been defined narrowly as conservation issues.
This is South African author Jacqueline Kok from the University of Witwatersrand.
And environmentalists or conservationists are seen to be people who are more concerned with animals than with people, more concerned with protecting the black rhinoceros, which is an endangered species, than with poverty and the needs of people. And not only is environmentalism seen as a white middle class issue, and I know you had the same pattern in the States until that 87 report on the relationship between toxic waste dumps, the sighting of toxic waste dumps and race, and that whole new movement, which I found very exciting, of environmental justice against mobilizing a broader range of people against environmental racism. That hasn't happened in South Africa yet. Talk to anybody. I would bet you a bottle of whiskey on this. Talk to anybody about environmental racism and they won't have heard of the concept. And it's very interesting because there's a process of percolation of ideas coming out of North America and Europe. People are beginning to talk about sustainable development. Okay, that appeared in the Brundtland report in 1987, so maybe there's a 6-year lag. But I think that notion of environmental justice and the whole movement that's developing in the States now, and the way it's incorporating people of color and trade unions and grassroots communities, that is potentially very, very exciting, and I hope very much that we'll see the same development here, but it hasn't started yet. So not only do we have no mass-based environmental movement, but the concept of the environment is stigmatized. It's interpreted narrowly to mean the conservation of threatened plants, animals, and wilderness areas, rather than the conservation of the natural resources on which all economic activity depends. And clearly, part of what I and many others are, or a few others are involved in now, is trying to redefine that notion of the environment, to link it to questions of health, to questions of development, in order to mobilize people around quality of life issues as well as the narrow conservation issues.
Jacqueline Kok has a powerful example of environmental racism.
When the South African government was deciding where to site our nuclear waste facility, they mapped the entire country and they drew lions outside a 50-mile radius of every white residential area. And those lions, that 50-mile radius encompassing every white residential area, was defined the spaces, the so-called empty spaces where the nuclear waste facility could be sited. And in the end, it was sited at a place in Namaqualand, very near a local Namaqua community.
Dr. Koch is all in favor of the idea that the environment must be considered a national security issue.
Well, I've been trying to say this. I don't know if you read an article by Robert Kaplan in the Atlantic Monthly, which someone sent to me, in which he argues that the environment is the national security issue of the 21st century. And I've been trying to, and there are many different people who are saying we need a new, different, alternative approach to security, because what threatens our security is no longer those concrete military threats, that environmental deterioration and issues of poverty and social justice. These are the real threats to the security and freedom of people. And that's an argument which a few lone voices are trying to make. I mean, the nicest in this article I wrote for Business Day last week, trying to argue against increases in the defense budget, I tried to make this point by saying that defining our security in militarist terms was like, and I took the image from a theorist called Tandon, where he talks about it being large defense expenditure on these large armies is like dismantling a house in order to erect a fence around it, which I think is a wonderful way of capturing the illogicality of military spending, again, high military spending against this phantom enemy, this non-existent enemy. The enemy is injustice, environmental deterioration, those sorts of issues.
Quite confined. We've been rightfully concerned, primarily concerned with the democratization of this country. Now, as that is that hegemony that has stuck us all together is going to be the reason for our solidarity is not going to be there in the near future. We have to begin to look at other issues, and environment is certainly one of those issues.
This is Chris Alberton. He's the founder of Earth Life Africa, one of the very few groups focusing on environmental issues in South Africa.
Trade unions have environmental issues. They have worker health and safety issues. Their activities impact upon communities outside of the factory gate. Civic organizations have major challenges in terms of water supply and sanitation, refuse removal, which are patently environmental issues. You have a number of different groupings, human rights groupings. There is a social trend globally, I think, that a lot of groupings, from the women's groupings to the human rights groupings to the environmental groupings, are beginning to find common ground and say, look, what unites us is all of our common vision for social justice. The environment is a thread that is woven right through the fabric of society, and we really have to look at issues of sustainability. We in South Africa never had the opportunity to participate in the Rio conference at UNCED in 1992. The issue of sustainability is becoming a bit of a buzzword in this country, but nobody has really looked at it and explored it and what it means. And you will look at government statements now, they talk about sustainable growth. And growth, sure, I mean, but we have to question what kind of growth and for who. And there isn't a richness of debate and understanding of the sustainable development agenda, in my opinion, in South Africa. So it's important for us to begin to interact with those countries who have the experience and who can share that with us.
You use the term sustainable development, and it seems like already in the developing world that term has been identified as sort of a code word that means no development, which means restraining development at least. And those people in the developing world who look at it that way say it's really the first world's fault, that they're the ones who have the industry and the consumption and the waste and the consumerism, and the concept of sustainable development is just one way of keeping the first world from paying any price for the environmental situation we find ourselves in, and making the developing world the place that pays a price for the problems we have now.
Sustainable development has come to mean whatever people want it to mean. I think this is where you have the GATT agreement, where you had essentially three or four power blocks making that agreement, and you're looking at the greening of trade, and you're looking at trade protectionism for green and environmental issues. A lot of people are arguing that it's just a new economic recolonization of the South. And it's a new way of maintaining your markets. And I think it's a lot more complex than that, and certainly it's about political power at the end of the day.
Yeah, and that's really the reason I asked, because here in South Africa you have the problem that you have the first world and what we used to call the third world living right next door to each other, so these people see the problem even more clearly than the rest of the world probably does.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that South Africa has got a lot of microcosms which could inform the world, and for me what is so exciting is that we have now the opportunity to, I mean, how often in history do you turn around and say, okay, the society that we've had is not good, hasn't worked, let's throw it out the window, let's build a new one. I mean, how often does that happen in history? We've got a tremendous opportunity here. We have a whole lot of conflicts which the world recognizes in itself. I think racism was so repugnant to the world because people recognize it existing in their own internal psyches as well as in their own societies. And I think we have very clearly demonstrated in our South African society a whole lot of problems that the world is trying to grapple with. And I think in that sense, South Africa is a delicate, new, and exciting, I don't like to use the word laboratory, because it's a living experiment, but it is something that I think a lot of the rest of the world can learn from. And we just need that chance. And that is what frightens me personally. You have the major players like the World Bank and the IMF and the multinational corporations coming in here and already beginning to have major influence on policy. And we just need a little bit of space. And I think unless we really stand up and try and put our arms out and keep some space to ourselves, people who come from the outside and try and say, okay, we've got the solutions because this didn't work in Paraguay and that didn't work in Chile, don't try it in South Africa, then we're never going to really know if we fail, whether it's our own fault or people outside meddling. But if people can really give us our own space to get on with things and really try and sort it out, I think we have the real ingredients to create something new and create a model that hasn't happened anywhere else.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground about the fledgling environmental movement in South Africa. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
The African National Congress is paying, on the whole, lip service to environmental issues through mainly a factor of people not really recognizing the ecological links and the relevance of environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And I think your movement in the United States can really assist us a lot here in South Africa in terms of bringing those social justice links, making them a lot clearer.
This again is Chris Alberton from Earth Life Africa.
Every year in South Africa we use 25 tons of DDT. And that DDT has been used in the black homelands because those homelands, Gazankulu, Lebowa, Venda, and KwaZulu, which wasn't essentially strictly a homeland, but it was repositories for black people, those are the malaria areas, and they're using DDT to combat malaria. And now we've had big ongoing running battles with them, saying, look, there are alternatives. And people come back and say quite blatantly and openly and naively, well, that's too expensive. And what they do is they take the DDT and they go into the mud huts of people, of rural people. And the rationale is, well, what we'll do is we will spray the inside of the hut with DDT, because what happens is when a mosquito bites somebody, It's heavily laden like an aeroplane full of baggage. It can't move very fast or very far, and it'll go and settle on the wall of the hut. And so that is the official government program to combat malaria. Spray DDT inside poor, already disadvantaged, malnourished people's homes. We are using a number of pesticides. I mean, for example, okay, we've got a huge marijuana growth industry in South Africa. Marijuana in Natal, for example, is bigger in terms of the revenue it generates than sugarcane. It's one of the biggest income earners in terms of cash crops. And what it also does is, okay, it benefits the informal economy in that sense, taking aside the negative consequences. But what the police have been doing is they've been spraying paraquat from helicopters. And what happens is they go, and the marijuana is grown all along the river courses, along the riverbeds. So they will go with their helicopters and their spray, and they'll sort of hover above this and spray their paraquat. Now, paraquat accumulates in the water, it binds to soil, it is toxic to fish, it's toxic to bees, it's toxic to wildlife. Not only does it kill the marijuana, but it kills the innocent people's maize crops grown next door or grown upstream with the drift. Paraquat is one of the dirty dozen identified by the Pesticide Action Network, and we had a meeting with the Minister of Police, who was then Minister Flock, and he said, "Oh, sure, okay, we'll look into it. Let's, you know, blah blah blah." Nothing happened. And you know, what we tried to do, and at that stage, the legal human rights organisations weren't looking into it, but we wanted to try and set up a court case where a rural peasant farmer who's a subsistent agriculturalist whose crops had been destroyed by this police program to spray the marijuana, and he wasn't growing marijuana, we wanted to set up a case where he could take it to court and sue the Department of Police. That never happened, but it might still happen.
In the metropolitan area surrounding the South African city of Durban is the township of Merrebank. About 50,000 people live there. They are mostly classified as Indian, but the important thing for environmental purposes is that the township is non-white.
We did some environmental impact studies. We got a study done and we found out that this is the fifth most polluted area in the world. So says
this Merrebank area.
This is the Merrebank area. Like we are like an island in a sea of industries.
This is Trevor Pillay. He's a member of the local civic organization, the Merrewent Ratepayers Association. As we toured the area, he described the situation.
There were studies done where we found that kids in the area had more. Had a higher problem, you know, health-related problems of like chest asthma and respiratory-related problems than in an area, say, like just up about 10 k's up, say, near Chatswood. And there were scientific studies done that, and it showed that does impact quite heavily on the people, yeah.
What are some of the industries that are right around here?
Well, we have the C.G. Smith Chemicals, we have Jenriff Oil Refinery, we have the Mondi Paper Mill, we have the sewage works, water treatment.
Now right here we're going by some homes who are, I mean, these are very close to industrial areas, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. This area, we call it the Navy area. Now we are going down to the C.G. Smith Chemicals there.
What's the name of the company again?
The C.G. Smith Chemicals.
C.G. Smith. C.G.
Yeah.
Smith.
Yeah.
What do they do there?
Well, they distill alcohol from cane, mostly cane byproducts, and there are other chemicals as well that they do manufacture.
These houses are literally right across the street from the industrial areas.
Yeah. Can you smell it?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. And these guys have no real respect or commitment. For example, there was an explosion some time ago, yeah, and it was bromide gas was put into the air. And these guys never informed us. We had got informed by people around who telephoned us. They managed to evacuate a nearby school, and when we did ask them why they didn't inform the community, their cynical answer was they forgot.
This is an oil refinery.
This is the oil refinery.
This is formerly Mobil?
Yeah, it's formerly Mobil. It's now called Genrep. It's sold to South African interests. Okay?
Now this is amazing because this, yeah. I mean, this is literally right in the middle of a residential.
Can you smell it?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay.
You can smell
this. And this canal is also all the effluent.
This canal goes right through the middle of where these people live.
Right. Going right into the Amlas River, which going into the sea. Okay.
And the thing is, these homes aren't. I mean, we visited squatter camps and other places like that's not what this is. I mean, these are nice homes.
These are homes. And can you see that tank there where there is scaffolding?
Yes.
There was an explosion on that tank.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, bits of debris and things came out. There was a huge ball of flame. Some of the trees beside got slightly scorched. There was a lady who collapsed, overcome by the fumes. So some people were nauseous, and then there was general panic as well, because they didn't know what the hell was happening.
What's the Ratepayers Association, what do they want these companies to do, and what have they been able to get them to do?
Okay, well, the fact that they are here is, we cannot do anything about that, the fact that they are here. But what we are saying is, for them to live in harmony with the community, and we need to know what chemicals they handle, what are the effects of it, what do we do in case there's an emergency, how do we react to that, and to also have some sort of plan with the community in terms of evacuation, how we they can also be beneficial to us, you know, in that respect. Okay, as you see, the pollution levels are very high. We'd like that to be reduced. We understand that we don't want these companies to close and go away or something like that. We are not wishing them away. What we're saying is live in harmony with us, work with us to try and get a cleaner environment and a more healthier environment.
Do a lot of the people who live in these homes work in those factories?
There is a fair amount of people that work in the factories, but a fair amount, yeah.
This road we're going down right now, we just turned the road past the refinery, and we can see the Indian Ocean right out here.
That is the Indian Ocean.
And in fact, it's very beautiful.
Yeah, it is, but not with what these guys are doing to it.
It's amazing. I mean, we just came through that neighborhood, past the plant, turned the corner, and this is a very beautiful spot here.
Yeah, we're right at the Indian Ocean. And, you know, if you speak to some of the older people here, they would tell you that this is one of the best fishing areas in this, in on this coastline. What has since then happened is they now say that the amount of marine life and stuff has drastically reduced.
You're an ANC representative, as well as part of the civic association.
That's right.
What do you hope from the new government? What powers will they be able to bring to bear to make the situation here in the Maryland area better?
Okay, what we'd like to see is legislation being passed in favor of the residents, in that in this area of Meerbang there's environmental impact studies carried out, and then we need to know what the international as well as national norms are, the in terms of the levels of pollution, the sulfur, to have set standards and to have legislation to ensure that goes ahead. We also want the government to pass legislation ensuring us the right to know what these companies, the chemicals they are handling, the dangers that they pose, and how do we react to that?
What we're really trying to do is strengthen civil society in terms of participating on issues of resource management, looking at who has access to the resources, who makes decisions as to how they're used, and who does it benefit. And most important, to say that a resource, whether it be a water source or land, or even a factory that's emitting pollution, the people most affected, the most involved, should be the ones that have the most say over how it's used.
This again is Chris Alberton,
experience has shown, not only in South Africa but globally, the more removed the decision maker is from the resource in terms of determining its usage, the more likely the decision of that decision maker is going to benefit other people removed from that resource rather than the people directly related to it. So one of our objectives is to really strengthen the role of, say, rural communities who are living next to a game park to really have a say and obtain benefits from what is happening there. That it's not the dollars that come in and the people, the wealthy people that come and have their recreation there, and then that goes to some private company elsewhere, because that is going to create social tensions anyway. And we have to really get local people involved. If a water, if an area is going to be dammed, the people who have to, who benefit or who suffer negative consequences from that, must have a very strong voice in making decisions as to how it is done.
Chris Alberton is founder of Earth Life Africa and national coordinator of the Environmental Justice Networking Forum in South Africa. Our other guests have been author and sociologist Jacqueline Koch of the University of Witwatersrand, and Trevor Pillay, who's a member of the Merrowint Ratepayers Association and a local representative of the African National Congress. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9430, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9430. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.